On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we hit 4 home runs, or at least the equivalent of that in podcast form, as we celebrate Kyle Schwarber going big fly 4 times last night against the Atlanta Braves. We fly around the league, introduce you to Peyton Tolley, the Red Sox top pitching prospect who is making his MLB debut tonight at home against Paul Skeens. And it's Friday, so of course we do the good, the bad, and the Trevor Jadaniel. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world. Unimpressed with Kyle Schwarber. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman, and I'd like to see him hit 4 home runs 2,131 games in a row before I start, you know, freaking out about the guy. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, it's true. Our conversation with Cal Ripken Jr. has really just ruined all other baseball achievements. Hopefully, you folks enjoyed that convo with the legend himself. I certainly did. I assume Jake had a decent time with that as well. That was okay. a pretty cool opportunity. But Cal Ripken Jr. never hit 4 home runs in the game, and that is why Kyle Schwarber is our opener.
If you are listening to this podcast, you already know the cold, very hard hit truth that last night, Kyle Schwarber of the Philadelphia Phillies, a man designated to hit, did just that, cranking 4 round trippers in a single game against the Atlanta Braves in a Phillies blowout win. This was the 3rd 4-homer game of the season, which is remarkable because I believe this is only the 21st 4-home-run game of all time. It is more rare than many, many, many baseball accomplishments that we celebrate. And the idea that we have 3 in one season, Gino Suarez, Nick Kurtz, and now Kyle Schwarber, that is remarkable. But this evening was all about Kyle Schwarber and Philadelphia getting to celebrate him as a character on their favorite team.
Yeah, and I think that this Schwarber season, while not that different than the last 3, it does seem that he has elevated his game in some respects that we can get into. I think from a narrative standpoint, he certainly has a lot more going for him this season than he has over the last few. And we'll get into the, is he belong in the NL MVP conversation? We'll get into that. But let's focus on this game itself. Now, 4 homers in a game is absurd, and we should note that it very well could have been 5 if ace reliever Vidal Brujan couldn't come in and shut Kyle Schwarber down in the 8th inning. But that is important, right? I mean, the Nick Kurtz 4-homer game, that 4th homer was off a position player, if I recall, in Houston. Yes. Schwarber had a chance at the first ever 5-homer game against Brujan. He was beaten up on some Braves pitchers that probably we certainly did not expect to be Braves pitchers this season. That was 1 off of Cal Quantrill. That is 2 off of Austin Cox. That is a 4th off of Wander Suero, who is one of my favorites, but is clearly not a very good major league pitcher anymore. And I think also the timing of this and we speak of the narrative and just how we've been talking about Schwarber, the series that the Phillies are coming off of, you know, getting embarrassed in Queens against the Mets, and Kyle Schwarber standing at his locker after every game and being like, look, man, we got to look forward. We got to look forward.
And he was terrible in that series.
He was terrible. He was 0 for 20, right? He was 0 for 20 over the last week. And then he shows up and is like, all right, guys, we're home. It's time to do my thing.
4 for 26 now over the last week.
Pretty good. It's still a crap week if you're asking me. But watching the highlights back, what stood out about these individual blasts?
I mean, the first, second, and fourth were very similar, right? It's the quick hands to a pitch that's inside and just roping it down the right field line. The 3rd home run was freak stuff. Left on left. Austin Cox throws a pitch away, and Schwarber just kind of like touches it, and the ball just goes out to left field. And I think it's a great reminder, that home run for me is a great reminder of what makes Schwarber such a powerful hitter, and how he has changed over time. So like when he debuts with the Cubs, he's a big boy, right? Like he is a soft bodied, pudgy, thick character. Okay. And at the time it's like, oh, well, that's where the power comes from. Like he's just big. Kyle Schwarber is not big anymore relative to baseball players. Like he's really not. He's about our height, you and I, like five, I would say probably 5'11".
Yeah.
Not a tall guy. And he's like strong. Like he's ripped. Like he's in really good shape. But in a way, like he should be appreciated for having power beyond his physical size. Because if you look at like the, you know, hard hit leaderboards, it's O'Neill Cruz, 6'7". Giancarlo, 6'6". Aaron Judge, 6'7". It's all these tall freaks and then like relatively tiny Kyle using his preposterously strong wrists, hands, and forearms to launch balls out.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? This dude is country strong. They built him different here in the Midwest. And Kyle Schwarber is just, and again, like he's been doing this for a while now. The fact that he found another level to reach, the fact that he could increase his, you know, he went from whatever 98th percentile hard hit rate to 100, and that he could increase his barrel rate and now has set a career high in home runs at 49 with a month to go at age, you know, 32 is really astonishing. And as we kind of zoom farther out and think about Schwarber as a character with the Phillies in the final year of this 4-year contract, which he has just been, again, like what an amazing performer, what an amazing contract, and one that has set him up to maybe sign one that's even bigger, which you certainly would not expect, even if you were optimistic about Kyle Schwarber, who at that point was, of course, a essentially DH only heading into his 30s. But he's as bankable as it gets when it comes to power production and on base. And he's got the same batting average as he did last year. But man, oh man, I mean, there's just a very, very short list of hitters that you would want on your team. And that's before you even get to everything that he obviously means to the team away from the field, which you have certainly gotten an up close look at over the years.
Dude, 2023, he hit a 188 batting average against left-handed pitching. Now, he did clobber 15 home runs. But he has taken enormous strides in that respect, facing same-sided pitching. I think that's what's really important to understand. And there have been a lot of good things written about it. I believe Matt Gelb over The Athletic wrote about Schwarber saying, you have to be prepared to die when you're facing a left-hander, staying in there, tracking the ball the whole way, not thinking it's going to hit you. And that's kind of just been the game changer for him. Like, he is a complete hitter. I believe he's like top 10 in OPS versus left-handed pitching amongst all hitters. Like not just including righties. And that really is a remarkable accomplishment. And I think elevates him as a hitter into a different tier. You know, you mentioned him as like this clubhouse freak in a good way. Over time, the more that we've spent around the game, I become more, not skeptical, but I just think that you can build a good clubhouse out of most people, right? There are very few people on either end of like a good or bad vibe spectrum. There are very few people that can soil a clubhouse, and I think there are very few people that can like save a clubhouse, right? And I do think that Schwarber is in the conversation. Willie Adames comes to mind, right, is like another guy who's just like a super clubhouse presence. There are others. But I think that it is significant. And, you know, Matt Gelb, who wrote about this last night, kind of touched on this in the article that he wrote about him going on Abbott Elementary after the game. Mm-hmm. So for people who didn't see this, like Abbott Elementary, incredible show set in Philadelphia. They had set this date up in advance to film at the park after the game. And as Matt wrote, like the Phillies needed someone to step up and do something. And if they need something, they go to Schwarber. You just go to Schwarber, right? And so Kyle agreed to do it. And then he hit 4 home runs and then had to like film television later that evening. Just a remarkable little nugget.
Yeah, and that'll be quite the cameo whenever we do get to see that. But no, it
wait, time out on that.
Yeah.
So the show, like that episode of Abbott Elementary, was probably like written 6 months ago, right? After Kyle Schwarber hits four home runs, literally hits four home runs the night that you're filming, does the script have to change? Like, do you have to reference it?
Right.
Does it become a part of the episode? I think it has to, right?
Yeah, it feels like those involved with that show like are probably nimble enough to do it. I don't know if it's relevant whatsoever, you know, what the scene is or what the setting is that requires Kyle Schwarber, like how many lines he has or whatever. But I would like to think that you would embrace the serendipity of that moment and like make it a reference. But I guess we'll see. Either way, to your point, like that is something that you can imagine after a game like that he would be the last person that you would ask to do something like that. And instead he's like, yeah, let's do TV.
In a way, like I need someone like he's the perfect person to do it after a game like that. But it's also like someone else on the Phillies should have stepped up, in my opinion. Mm. Like your dude just hit four home runs. Like, you know, like Jordan Romano, like get out there, Jordan, you know?
Right. The Abbott Elementary's like, yeah, could we at least get like Kepler? So, he's swinging it a little better lately.
If you're Abbott Elementary, right? If you're Abbott Elementary and you want a cameo from a Phillies player in the episode,
yeah,
which Phillies are significant enough to carry a cameo?
So I do think that the bar is lower for this team and how Philly this show is. Like,
okay,
I think that, like, honestly, with this crowd and the people, like, I think even Brandon Marsh is like a character enough. Right? Right? Like, even though,
of the hair.
You know, yeah, like people know who he is. So I think it's lower than on the other teams. That said,
I have the roster in front of me. I would say Turner, yes. Schwarber, yes. Harper, yes. Real Muto, yes.
Yeah.
Bohm, yes. Marsh, yes.
Yeah. Bohm's
yes.
Bohm's probably moved down the power rankings.
I think you could do Bohm and Stott together. Like, sure. That would pass the bar.
Sure. Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Bader,
Castellanos.
Yes, dude. Yes.
Castellanos is like, okay, who cares? He's at -1.5 or whatever, man.
Dude, Castellanos is going off script on Abbott Elementary. He is not reading
the
line
correctly.
Dude,
give me Otto Kemp before Nick Castellanos. All right, anyway, the point is
Kyle Schwarber, the Lehigh Valley offshoot of Abbott Elementary.
Exactly. Kyle Schwarber, what an evening for him. Fourth career three-homer game. Which only 18 players ever have done that, so that's pretty cool. And I wouldn't be surprised if he's got another one in him, or two, or three. The record is six, tied Johnny Mize, Sammy Sosa, and Mookie Betts, which, by the way, Mookie Betts having
amazing.
Six three-homer games is one of the more absurd things about his entire career. But yeah, Schwarber could absolutely do this again. I mean, that's what he, when he's locked in, and you mentioned that third home run, the pitch and the swing and the reaction from Schwarber and the reaction from Austin Cox was basically just like, there was literally no pitch I could throw that wasn't going to end up over the fence. And that is pretty much how it felt watching Kyle Schwarber until Vidal Brujan miraculously managed to get Kyle Schwarber to pop out when he was clearly trying to hit that fifth home run.
Well, and Schwarber said this after the fact in the batting cage before his last at bat, he said to someone, has anybody ever hit five? Which, I mean, ultimate jinx, my man. So my question, let's do the MVP thing. Okay, let's have the MVP conversation. I think that right now it's hard to envision not giving it to the guy who also pitches. Shohei Ohtani, whose offensive line as a whole is about equal to Schwarber's, if not a little bit better. We have two designated hitters from an offensive perspective at the top of this list. The difference is, last night, Shohei Ohtani pitched five innings.
And or I guess it was a couple nights ago, but Ohtani got through five innings for the first time this season. He threw more curveballs than ever, more splitters to right-handers. what became clear in Ohtani talking about his kind of pitch mix after the game is that he really has been treating these first few starts like rehab starts, where he is just working on stuff. He is working his stuff back into his, you know, his arsenal against major leaguers in games that matter in a division race and all these things. And the Dodgers are letting him do that because he is the best player to ever live. Totally understandable. Now, that said, it makes you realize and remember what he is capable of when he is throwing all of his pitches, when he does have six, seven pitches at his disposal, and the velocity is up to 100, and the command is slowly coming back. And it's like, oh, yeah, right. He is one of the best pitchers on the planet as well. He is helping his team win games on the mound, in addition to also being on pace for, you know, another 50-homer season. And it is interesting coming off of last year where Ohtani did win the MVP as a DH only and make us rethink, like, okay, you know what? If you are cool enough and good enough as a DH, you can win it. Yeah. Obviously, he stole 50 bases, and that certainly helped his case as well. Schwarber has, I think, 10. I think what's really difficult about Schwarber's case this year is a few things, because all the things, we can't say enough good things about him, but Kyle Schwarber has been, you know, 90% of this for the last 3 years, he has never received a vote higher than seventh. He has never finished in the top 10. He has never even come close to being in the conversation. Now, you could argue, well, hey, wait a minute, maybe we've been wrong the whole time and we should have been voted for Kyle Schwarber. And I recognize that this is probably, I mean, clearly his best season. So he has elevated his case. But that would be quite the leap for him to go from nowhere in the top 10 to the biggest challenger to Ohtani, especially when you still look at WAR. You know, Trey Turner's top three in Fangraphs WAR in the National League, and there are other good candidates.
I think you are, like, he has taken a notable jump, right?
Sure.
Yeah. From a home run production standpoint. That's undeniable. I think that the narrative works in Schwarber's favor as well, because we're having relative down years from Harper. Real Muto's fallen off. Castellanos is not very good. The Phillies have needed Kyle Schwarber to be a game-changing force in order to still likely, I mean, it's five games, win the NL East, right? Like, they have needed that to get to that. Not to say that the Dodgers haven't leaned on Shohei Ohtani. I'm clear. I understand that. But there is a number of home runs that Schwarber can get to where it's an uncomfortable conversation. Like, right now, I still think it's Ohtani, if you're voting. Kyle Schwarber is at 49 home runs. If he finishes with 60, right? If he finishes with 60 and Ohtani is like at 52, I know that there's more that goes into it than that. It's going to be difficult. I do think Schwarber might get some votes if he finishes with 60 homers. So, you know, nine seasons ever with at least 60, right? Ever. Nine seasons ever. And most of those guys were the MVP. Roger Maris in 61, Barry Bonds in 2001, Aaron Judge in 2022. I don't know what in the world happened to Sammy Sosa in 1999 when he hit 60 home runs and finished ninth in the MVP voting.
What happened was he...
Everyone was doing that.
Well, what happened was he did it the year before and it wasn't as cool. So, and he won the year before. Right. So,
okay. So,
but
this is
to that point,
silly.
To that point, though,
if Kyle Schwarber hits 74 home runs, he's the MVP. Like, okay sure, let's just start there.
If Kyle Schwarber keeps racking up four homer games and gets to 74, yes, I think
he's my point is that, like, if he gets to 74, he's the MVP. If he does not hit another home run the rest of the year, he's not the MVP. There is a number of home runs that he can, like, theoretically hit between now and the last game where you're like, that's the MVP. Jordan, is it that simple for you? Is it as simple as he gets to 65 and you're like, that's the MVP?
I guess there's a number. The problem, it is sort of similar to the conversation we were already having about Kyle Raleigh, which is like, how many more home runs does he have to hit than Aaron Judge to win if Judge's OPS is 100 points higher? And obviously Judge, I know he finally homered again recently, but like, he also went in a bit of a skid over 3 weeks where the OPS started to fall and he got hurt and whatever. But the point is it's like, okay, is it just about the number of home runs? To me, it shouldn't be. I understand, if you're talking about a historic total, I get that. The problem is that at this point, we're going to get four or five more starts of Ohtani We're going to be looking at it's not like he's that far behind. Would it be shocking if Ohtani ends up with more home runs than Schwarber? Also, no. But in the scenario where Schwarber has 10 more and Ohtani is just like getting blasted and giving up homers and only going 3-4 innings, that would be like, honestly, like Ohtani has to be bad on the mound as far as I'm concerned. He has to be almost making it harder for the Dodgers to win games.
He has to be like a neutral value on the mound.
Yeah, but or like he's not going deep into games, and so they're taxing the bullpen, and they're having to, you know, like it would have to be. It's still amazing that he's doing it, and it's not taking that away from him. But that's what's going to have to happen, because otherwise, it's just I just don't see how it's possible. Now that said, Schwarber finishing second because of the context that I just gave, which is that he's never finished in the top 10, would be amazing. And I think maybe ends up being deserved. I think that is going to be interesting when we compare him to a teammate like Turner, PCA, if he heats back up, right? You know, Lindor is going to have another 30-30 season as an awesome shortstop. Like, there are going to be other good candidates, but right now there does seem to be enough of a gap that, like, people want to vote. People want to push for Schwarber, and I totally get that.
Just Juan Soto. Also pretty good. Worth a mention.
Yeah, but easy.
Does Schwarber get a first place vote?
I don't think it's as likely as Cal Raleigh getting a first place vote at this point.
I think, but, and I don't know if you've been meaning to do this.
Yeah.
I think you've been drastically underrating Cal Raleigh's odds of winning MVP.
Oh, well, no, at this point, I know. I know Cal Raleigh is now like firmly in coin flip territory. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying, like, you think it's more likely that Cal Raleigh gets a first place vote. Like, I think Cal Raleigh could nap for a month.
Okay.
And he'd get a first place vote.
Okay, fine, fine. Okay, so then move Cal Raleigh aside. Do I think Kyle Schwarber will get a first place vote? At this point, no. I think there's a path there. At this point, no. Unless we are already at the point where people are bored by Ohtani, which I guess is possible. It's going to depend on who those 30 MVP voters are. I guess that's possible. I don't think so. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. That said, I think the last thing we say about Schwarber before we take a break is, we've already hinted at his free agency coming up and what it's going to cost and if the Phillies are going to be able to get an extension done. Everything he said is, of course, he'd love to stay there. They've said John Middleton's been like, we are going to do everything we can to keep him there, and I believe that's all true. That said, man, price of the brick going up. And I don't know where this is going to get to. I don't know what this is going to look at. And if you're Schwarber, it's like, listen, he might love Philadelphia, but why would he do them any favors? He is playing himself into more and more money by the week, and he's going to earn it.
So I talked to him about this when they were in DC last week. I was like, how are you wrangling with a walk year? Really, for the first time. Like, I know he had... he was not tendered, and then he's with the Red Sox and the Nats and Red Sox and whatever. This is a little bit different, right?
Yeah.
And he was like, it was the most like Kyle Schwarber answer ever. And he's like, if I was thinking about my free agency all season, every time I hit a home run or did something good, that's a disservice to the team I'm on right now. And so he's like, I'm just not thinking about it. Like, what is the point of thinking about this thing that I cannot control until it happens? And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why we haven't really heard of any extension buzz, right? I think he wants to hitting the open market will make him more money, almost certainly. Like, I think he wants to focus on this. It is one of the more fascinating free agent cases that we've seen.
Yeah.
And we've been chatting, like, who gets more money, him or Pete? And I think it's every week it's more definitive in my mind that even though Schwarber does not play defense and is 2 years older, I do think he ends up getting a bigger contract than Alonso.
I think that's accurate. All right, let us take a break. When we return, we'll go around the league. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbercast. Welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Let's go around the league. We have three bits of news to zoom in on this lovely Friday morning. Let's begin in Boston, where we're getting another juicy MLB debut. We spoke earlier this week about Jonah Tong, who will be making his debut for the Mets. We have also talked about Nolan McLean, who has impressed. We're going to give him a little bit more love after this conversation. But we have to talk about Peyton Tolley, who we did mention briefly in our podcast devoted to some prospect check-ins and, you know, the biggest risers in the minor leagues this season. We talked about this guy who is kind of raced to the upper levels with Boston. But even at that point, it seemed kind of difficult to fathom that this guy who was drafted last year and hadn't even thrown a pro pitch before the season and started an A-ball was actually going to pitch in the big leagues this year, this big left-handed pitcher, Peyton Tolley. And yet it seems like kind of similar to the Mets, the Red Sox are looking at their pitching staff and they're like, you know what? This dude's one of our best pitchers, so come on down and make your debut against Paul Skeens and the Pittsburgh Pirates at Fenway Park on Friday. So, Jake, let's remind people who Peyton Tolley is and how he got to this point.
Tough morning for Garrett Crochet and Lucas Giolito, who at 6'6", 245, the both of them, are no longer the biggest boys on the Red Sox pitching staff, as Tolley comes in at 6'6", 250.
He's got this five. We're putting together quite the team here, man.
And that's the first thing, right? Like, how do you beat the Yankees and their enormous hitters? You get enormous pitchers.
Oh, I didn't think about that. You know, it's true. It's true. Aroldis Chapman, also one of, you know, physical specimen, is certainly having an amazing season for them. But Dustin Tolley May listed it.
Dustin May listed at 6'6", 180.
Right. It is funny, though, because Tolley, you mentioned, is a different kind of big than Crochet and Giolito. Tolley is truly built like an ox, right? I mean, this dude was a slugger. His first 2 years at Wichita State, a two-way player, more of a hitter. He transfers to TCU, and they are like, dude, you're got something special on the mound if you focus on that. I know hitting home runs is cool, but we don't need them as much from you here at TCU as they needed them in Wichita State. So why don't you focus on the mound, put the bat down, and he just took off. And what is so amazing about what has happened with him since he got into pro ball, the reason why teams were excited about him out of the draft is because he had elite extension and this fastball that had incredible characteristics that were missing a lot of bats in the zone. And in college, he was only throwing
like 91.
90, 91, 92. He would bump a 95, you know, early in the game, but it was like kind of a magic fastball that didn't have the velo, but was really impactful. He gets into pro ball, and with Boston, he's basically been sitting 94, 95, 96, and now a pitch that was already really effective has just become one of the best pitchers in the minors, and a pitch that clearly the Red Sox believe will just dominate major league hitters already. The rest of his arsenal, he's still figuring out, but the strike throwing has been good enough, and the stamina and the velo has kind of held up deep into starts that he started in A-ball, got to AAA, and now he's going to start in the big leagues. And I don't know if he's going to stick in this rotation. Would he get a playoff start over a Giolito or a Bayo? Like, I don't know. Maybe he pitches his way into that. But right now, the Red Sox are just trying to win as many games as possible, and they think Peyton Tolley can help them do that.
I've never met Peyton Tolley. Never talked to him. He just exudes a jolliness to him, both on the mound and off it, that I find to be incredibly endearing, and I think will make him a huge fan favorite in Boston. If he is any good, he is going to be a star in that town.
Yeah. And it's a fun contrast to the kind of on mound persona of a Crochet and some of the other pitchers that they have. I think he can kind of blend that in a pretty fun way. And yeah, I mean, Tolley's personal story too, by all accounts, an incredible personality. Also, I just have to mention, this is someone who has dealt with a lot over the last 2 years. His mother passed away from a long battle with cancer about a month before he was drafted last summer. And Chris Cotillo has an incredible story that I retweeted just about his relationship with his mom and how she inspired him and just like what an amazing person she was. So I encourage people to check that out. That's obviously a story that's going to be told a lot as he now gets to the big leagues. But no, he just seems like a delight and someone that I'm sure was not expecting to be in the big leagues when he started in A-ball this year. But here he is, totally against Paul Skeens. This is, now I'll be tuning in for that. I'll be in the Cleveland press box, but I'm going to be watching this for sure.
I think that we've had these a number of notable debuts from pitchers recently, prospect pitchers. Nolan McClain, we got Jonah Tong tonight, got Peyton Tolley tonight, Bubba Chandler coming up.
Yeah.
And I think that there really is, there are few regular season events better than the debut of a star prospect pitcher.
Yeah.
Because you learn about it a couple days in advance. If it's a home game, ticket sales go up. And ticket sales go up, not to belittle a more casual fan, but ticket sales go up amongst the ball knowers. So like the people who are like, oh, I got to go see Peyton Tolley on Friday. Those are the fans that like care. And I think that it makes that environment like particularly better. And I'm saying this to someone, you, Jordan, who you were at the greatest one of these of all time.
Right.
Which was Steven Strasburg's debut.
Yes, yes, yes.
And you've gotten to see a lot of cool baseball stuff over the years. And I imagine that Strasburg debut is still in your top three, top five.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, so the Strasburg thing is going to be tough to top. But it's so true. And I think that the bar is also lower. It doesn't have to be the best pitching prospect in baseball. But yeah, there is something really cool about just like seeing a pitcher for the first time trying to figure out major league hitters and understanding what that stuff looks like, understanding what it looks like on TV, on a big league mound, on a big league broadcast, and the angles and how the pitches move and how the delivery looks. And sometimes guys go out there and they get shelled, and sometimes they go out there and they're awesome. And either way, that is just something that is so special. And I totally agree with you. It is totally different than a left fielder debuting or a second baseman getting three at-bats and grounding out a couple times. The pitcher has the ball. The pitcher has the stage, whether it goes well or not. They have that moment. And, you know, I'm glad Bubba Chandler ended up getting it out of the bullpen just because he's so awesome and it worked out. But, like, that's also why it's annoying when guys don't get to actually start because they should have that opportunity.
Totally agree with you. And I think that what the Red Sox did here with Tolley and what the Mets kind of did with McClain and Tong is very interesting in the timing of when you call a guy up. And I'm curious, you know, people within the game, if you're listening, like reach out to me and let me know, is there something to holding that horse back? Holding the card back, holding that bullet back for later in the season. Because, like, I think Nolan McClain and Jonah Tong and Peyton Tolley had the stuff to get big league hitters out in May, right? Like, they could have come up in May. And I think in a different era, maybe with different team constructions, they do come up in May or earlier in the year. But, like, if you manage the workload and you bring them up now for a playoff push, like you're potentially getting a dude who's fresh, who's injecting energy, who the league does not have time to adjust to. Cam Schlittler is another example of this, right? Where it's like,
yeah, absolutely.
Unleash this dude who is a mystery onto hitters.
Last thing on Tolley, and then I want you to tell us more about Nolan McClain because he's really grabbing some attention this week. I just want to also mention that, like, you know, I'm wearing my Woo Sox hat today. This has been an amazing season for the Boston Red Sox farm system. It has not all gone to plan, but when you think about what we talked about this week, going into it, like, if you were looking at this group and we were wondering how this was going to go, and Roman Anthony's as advertised. Christian Campbell was as advertised and then flopped. And now maybe he'll come back. Marcelo Meyer looked good, looked bad, and now he's hurt. And now Peyton Tolley just zooms all the way to the big leagues, right? When you look at farm systems that get all this hype, you never know how it's going to go. And it's kind of cool to now reflect and be like, all right, like, and this is, by the way, going to change a million times again over the next year and 5 years and 10 years. But and then you have, you know, other rookies like Carlos Narvaez and Hunter Dobbins are producing way more than you expected. So it's just another nice little kernel of not predicting ball. Josenson Garcia, right? It's another guy that's like, wow, what a story he is. So Anyway, Red Sox farm system, cheers to you. Shouts out to Smiley and the Woo Sox. All right, Jake, let's talk about Nolan McLain a little bit. We will see what Jonah Tong gives us tonight against Yuri Perez and the Marlins. That is another fun pitching matchup. But Nolan McLain, what he did to the Phillies this week, I think, really grabbed the attention of a rival, right? The way that the Phillies booth was talking about what they saw, I think, said a lot about what he's been able to do. I know you've now been able to see him, I guess, twice in person, if I'm not mistaken. So, again, I know we've already sort of talked about him a little bit since he debuted, but it seems like he kind of took another step this week. And I know you.
Yeah, right. I mean, I tweeted out the very tailored fun fact that it's the best three-start to a career for a Mets starter since literally Tom Seaver. Like, yeah, there you go.
Good pitcher. Yep.
And McLain, a couple things here. So I was there at that game. First of all, he just looks so old for a 24-year-old, right?
The facial hair is doing a lot of lifting.
When you see him on TV, you're like, that's 24? And that goes back and, you know, he's been old now for his age for a long time, where he was one of the more famous high school baseball players in the country as like a sophomore. He was like the starting quarterback on his high school team as a sophomore. He had a full beard as a junior. He's been built like an adult man for like 10 years, right? And his own expectations of himself as an elite athlete were kind of sprinkled over these various activities, whether it was being a quarterback literally at Oklahoma State, right? Or hitting, or playing defense at third base, or learning to play the outfield at Oklahoma State. And now all of that energy is being concentrated into pitching for literally a year. This is the first season of his entire life that he is exclusively a pitcher. And so he is able, and it's similar with Toley, right? Where it's like when you're going into the, like when you're focusing on that thing specifically, you're just getting more out of your abilities. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing with McLain. The arsenal is preposterous. He's got six pitches. He can locate them. It was also very interesting to hear Hayden Senger, who caught that game, talk after of like, because he has six pitches, you can be super creative with sequencing. So like, if you watch Nolan McLain and you just watch like the breaking ball and the fastball, you're like, how the hell is he going to get lefties out? Right? Because it's the arm angle super to the side, lefties are going to see it for a long time. But because he can attack a lefty in so many different ways, it opens up a lot more avenues and doors for sequencing. And I just thought that was an interesting way to go about it. And like, he's not going to start game one of a playoff series, like, unless it doesn't line up. It will be David Peterson.
Yeah, yeah.
He should start game two.
Sure.
He should start game two. He is, in my opinion, he's the best pitcher on the Mets right now. Non-Edwin Diaz category. Like, he's the best pitcher on the Mets. And I think it is fascinating that we're now in a situation where the Mets pitching rotation in the playoffs could be two crafty lefties, Peterson, Manaea, and two rookies. Like, there is a world in which Jonah Tong carves over the next couple of starts, and you're like, that kid also has to be in the rotation. Because the only person on this roster with better stuff than Nolan McLain is probably Jonah Tong.
Right, right. I mean, listen, let's not forget about Senga. But it is interesting, and the same thing with Boston, where it's like you looked at the pitchers that they had, the veteran pitchers they had coming into the season, and the fact that they're having to rely on Toley. Same thing with the Mets. Although the Mets, you sort of could have seen him coming a little bit more. You can view it as a positive, which is, oh my God, these kids are awesome. And the negative, which is, wow, all of these veterans have, or most of these veterans have either been injured or disappointed. We know Frankie Montas is now a total non-factor. Not that even if he was healthy, he would probably be in this conversation. But that was a significant investment that has turned into nothing. We know Clay Holmes has kind of faded after a strong first half. So yeah, I'm with you. I'm excited to watch McLain. And last thing on McLain, and then we'll do one more bit of news. I mean, totally agree. Understand the depth of the arsenal is important, all those things. This breaking ball is one of the more
both of them.
Ridiculous two of them. Pitches. Two of them, yes. But I mean,
curve and a slider, sweeper.
Yeah, the curve and the sweeper. The sweeper is, you know, mid-80s. The curve's a little bit slower. I mean, I can't remember too many breaking balls that are that ridiculous. I mean, truly,
They look different. They look different.
Yeah. Yep.
Like it.
Yep.
I'm trying to think of like the way to describe it. It's almost like a lasso or like a Beyblade.
Yeah. Yeah, right, dude, the way it comes out. They're ripping it. And listen, I'm sure we've had great breaking balls from young pitchers since, you know, Jose Fernandez. But Jose Fernandez is the one that I always think about in terms of just like, I have not really seen a pitch move like that before. I think about like when Otani's ripping them, which I don't feel like he is yet, which is probably for the best for his elbow. But that pitch to Trout in the WBC, I mean, that's the kind of, you know, horizontal movement that you really are only getting if you are some kind of supinator, because you really got to rip it to get. And by the way, we also know McLean, it's also just objective. The spin rates are already the best in the league, right? It's not just what it looks like. That's not an accident. So he does have a very, very special ability.
One last bit of Mets news. Francisco Alvarez, who was dealing with a ligament issue in his right thumb, his throwing thumb, was basically, it was like, okay, his thumb is really effed up and like he is going to be in pain all year and he's going to give it a go. So he goes and does a rehab start at like in the minors and he's catching and he gets hit on his other hand and fractures a pinky on his left hand. So now he's almost walking around. It's like, what was it, that soccer spoof video of the goalie who keeps getting hit in the head?
Scott Sterling.
Scott Sterling.
I was thinking that too. I was going to reference the same thing. Yeah.
And Scott, you just have Francisco Alvarez, this poor guy walking around with like two hands that don't work. He's just like holding the bat like with his fists.
Yeah, I mean, again, I admire him trying to play through this, and I don't know exactly if he's going to be able to come back from this. Obviously, it's been a weird trajectory for Alvarez this season, regardless of the injuries. So we'll see, but it is, I mean, again, like, yeah, Mets catching situation is...
Let's Senger cook.
Not awesome. I love Luis Torrens, Mariners legend, but anyway. All right, one more thing before we take a break. Brewers getting some bad injury news as Trevor McGill, their closer. I mean, he's the closer. Like, again, we think about the Brewers as mixing and matching, but no, this dude's been handling the ninth inning. He's had some rough outings recently, and now he goes to the IL with the flexor strain, which could put his availability for the postseason in doubt. The Brewers do have other good relievers, but this does shake things up. This is going to put the spotlight on the, you know, Abner Uribes of the world. And I mean, who else could slide into some save opportunities here? I guess Shelby Miller, who, you know, they traded for, Nick Mears, maybe we'll see. Do you see Tobias Myers was throwing 98 yesterday, which is like, okay, sure. He's in the bullpen now and throwing kind of hard. They just signed Eric Fetty, but that's not like a back end guy. He's just there to cover innings. So, I don't know, man. It's not great.
Ball knowers, check in with me. The X factor for the Milwaukee Brewers, a man who I feel very confident will be the extra pitcher called up next week, is Craig Yoho. Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
So who is Craig Yoho? Craig Yoho is like, it's basically like an 80 grade changeup, right? It's like a top of the charts.
Yeah. He ain't throwing that hard, but this combo is something.
And he has been in the majors like a couple times this year, but it seems like they're not keeping him up there because he's got tons of options because he's a younger player. And so they can just move him up and down. He has allowed one earned run since July 4th. Like,
yeah.
And I just keep an eye on Craig Yoho. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. I'm torn on it. Cause it's like, I agree. I would not be surprised if he comes up. But also, it's not the profile that normally goes in the ninth inning in the postseason.
Oh, not in the ninth inning.
Yeah, but he is important. The thing I'm wondering, maybe this is a terrible, horrible take, is what happens with Miz as his innings go up. And if they have other starters, I know he had a much better start the other day, is if he's someone that they put back in the bullpen as they get to the postseason, if they feel like they have other starters that they trust are not going to have a total meltdown outing
so,
where they walk four or five.
But Jacob Mizorowski, before the All-Star break, had allowed like 8 runs in 5 starts. He has allowed 13 runs in 5 starts since, with way fewer innings pitched. His ERA since the All-Star break is 6.50. Yeah. Call him
he
Jacob.
Better. He looked better the other day, but...
Call him Mid-Zarowski.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. So I don't know. I just, that's another one to watch, especially because of the innings. And like, obviously it would play in relief, but I don't know. There's also risk to that for a lot of reasons. And just like, it's bouncing like, oh back. Man, he'd be throwing 105 in the bullpen. But it's like, okay, yeah, but you know what you don't want is the guy coming in and walking 3 guys in the 8th inning of a close postseason game. So there's risk there. But I am monitoring that. How they kind of shuffle their pitching staff now with McGill out is going to be very interesting. All right, let's take a break. When we return, it's Friday. It's the Good, the Bad, the Ugly. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. It is Friday morning, which means it is time for the good, the bad, and the ugly. One thing good, one thing bad, one thing bizarre that reminds us of His Highness Dan Ugla. Jordan, I am back in New York City right now for the first time since I moved. And New York City, besides being a Knicks town, it's a baseball town, right? And despite that, very rarely do the Yankees and Mets play here at the same time. The schedule is generally designed in a way for teams that are geographically close to one another to not overlap home games. That is the case in New York. It is the case with Baltimore and DC. I believe it is the case with the White Sox and the Cubs. And that is to ensure that, like, if you want to go to a ball game, there's a ball game in town, right? Now, this week, schedule quirk, they overlapped. And the Mets outdrew the Yankees 4 of the 5 days in which they were both home at the same time. Now, there were some times where it was like a Yankee day game and the Mets were playing a bigger opponent. I understand that. I think this is unequivocally a good thing. This is not to, like, be anti-Yankees. This is a good thing to me because the more people in the city that care about baseball, it's good for everyone. It's good for us. And I think the Mets rise, like presenting a legitimate challenge to the popularity of the Yankees in the city, is both relatively unrealistic in the short term because of the cultural stranglehold the Yankees have just on the world, but also in New York. But I do think that that is a compelling storyline to follow, and in a way, part of the Steve Cohen grand master plan, right, is how can we get more people to love the Mets? And even though the Mets have been very frustrating at times this year, their attendance has been an unequivocal good all season long, and to see them outdraw the Yankees while the Yankees were in town as well, very impressive, and I just think like a good thing for ball.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, obviously Phillies versus Nats is probably impacting some of the number of the total there in terms of who wants to go see those games. I don't know how many Nats fans are coming up to New York versus Phillies fans for those games. But either way, I agree with your point. The Mets attendance surge this year is not an accident, and clearly something that as Steve Cohen builds up the area around Citi Field over the next, you know, decade, that is something too that, and by the way, I would say, I mean, even when I lived in New York and you know this, like, I enjoyed going to Mets games more than Yankees games, regardless of the teams on the field. Like, I just enjoy Citi Field more and the general vibe. So it wouldn't be shocking to me if that is something that they can make happen for the casual baseball fan who just wants to go to a baseball game. I can imagine getting to a point where Citi Field becomes way more attractive. My good this week is Willy Adames. The Giants swept the Cubs. First time Cubs have been swept this year in a full series, not counting their Tokyo 0-2 experience. The Giants, on the whole, are still kind of an embarrassing situation considering what they invested in the season before the season and trading for Devers and just disappointing all around. Maybe they have a big September where they, you know, push their way into the wild card race. That said, Willy Adames playing better brings me joy because Willy Adames is one of the easiest guys to root for. And it was not looking good for the first few months. And it was like, oh no, what have they gotten themselves into? Is this still going to be a great contract over the long term? I don't know. But to see him start to look like the player that we have been watching over the last few years, to see him maybe have a chance to hit 30 home runs as a Giant. I mean, he's up to 24 now. And, you know, we've wondered, when are we going to see someone on the Giants hit 30 home runs again? Because it hasn't happened since Barry Bonds. Willie's got a shot here. I mean, when he gets hot, he can really, really go. He's got a two-homer game this week. So if Willie kind of bounces back and becomes that, even in maybe a lost Giants season, that would be really cool. And then combine it with, like, he's still a tremendously fun defensive shortstop. So add all that to just, like, one of the easiest guys to root for in the game. And it's just nice to see him playing again because watching him over the first few months was really bumming me out.
What's bad for me? So much. But we'll keep it on the field. Shinusuke Ogasawara, Nationals reliever, step into my office. We need to have a talk. I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed. The Washington Nationals, who are a calamity, were getting obliterated by the New York Yankees on Wednesday afternoon at the stadium when a catcher's interference on Drew Millis forced the Nats catcher from the game. Now, that wouldn't be the end of the world. He got his hand doinked by a swing. I believe it was Austin Wells, catcher on catcher violence. Now, the problem is that Riley Adams, the Nats' backup catcher, was in the DH spot, not on the bench that day. So he had to go catch, meaning the Nationals forewent their designated hitter against the Yankees in, like, the third inning. Like, right away. And so Shinusuke Ogasawara, who has had a very bizarre debut season here in the States, being in Rochester for like the first 3 months, getting called up to make a spot start the day they fire Davey Martinez and Mike Rizzo, getting sent back down, now being like the long man out of the pen. He steps up to the plate as a lefty, okay, to face Max Fried in the fifth inning. Now, I'm not putting Shinusuke in bad because he struck out. Like that, you're facing Max Fried. In fact, he looked impressively hitterish at the plate. Like if you just watched him, you'd be like, oh yeah, he's like a good little second baseman.
right, yeah.
The reason he's in bad is he didn't swing. And I understand you don't want the guy to get hurt. I get that. Take a hack, brother. Take a hack. Take a swing.
Especially, also bad, he didn't even come back out. So the Nats could have pinch hit for him there and then brought in another pitcher. And instead, they were like, yeah, go up there and don't swing and then we'll take you out anyway. I'm like, what are we doing?
Also, lefty, the come short on. Porch at Yankee Stadium, like, you can make a memory.
Go for it. Go for glory, man. Go for glory.
We have so few pitcher hitting situations now that, like, when they happen, what I don't want is, like, to be teased, right? I don't want it to be like, oh, this pitcher's hitting, gotta tune in, and then they just don't swing. Like, if you're, here's my take. If you're a pitcher hitting in baseball now and you don't swing, you should have to be removed from the game. You should have to take one swing in order to remain in the game.
No, I agree. And in this case, he was removed anyway because the Nationals are the Nationals. All right, my bad this week. The Angels of Los Angeles, Anaheim, and beyond. They lost 20-3 against the Rangers this week. Their run differential has fallen to -105, which is the third worst in Major League Baseball. That is a travesty. Is this team going to lose as many games as they did last year? No. Are they still one of the worst teams in baseball? Yes. That is so disappointing. And just, this is more ugly than bad. The Angels have now lost every series since the trade deadline, except for one, when they swept the Dodgers.
Hell yeah, dude.
So I don't understand. I guess, yeah, they're 6-0 against the Dodgers this year. And very bad against everybody else. That is that is the Angels' experience, which is a bad one. Let's go to Ugla.
Trevor Jadaniel Rogers. You know about this?
Oh, I do. Although I'm not sure why. Do you actually have any like background on this? I still have not seen Trevor Rogers talk about this.
Aha. Aha. So Trevor Rogers, who has been...
Give it to me. I'm actually excited about this. Yes.
Trevor Rogers, who's been the best pitcher in baseball for months now, is a gangly, pale, white kid from pretty rural New Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Way out there.
Now, Carlsbad, not to racially...
Did I remember that correctly?
Carlsbad. Not to racially profile anybody, but he does not look or present as someone whose middle name is Jadaniel. Okay. J apostrophe Daniel. Now, fascinating. Trevor Jadaniel Rogers. Now, this stood out for people, and you know, it's been noted on the Twitter machine. Andy Cuska of the Baltimore Banner got to the bottom of this. He tweets, asked the critical Trevor Rogers question. Why is his middle name Jadaniel? Answer, it's not. It's actually J-Daniel with a hyphen.
Oh, my goodness.
Not like J-Daniel with a hyphen, and it was entered wrong by MLB, and he never fixed it. His paternal grandfather is J-D. His maternal grandpa is Daniel. So his middle name is J. Daniel, a nod to both.
Wow. I mean, still unusual, J-Daniel.
To have a hyphen,
middle name, have a hyphen
in your middle name after a single letter? Yeah, that is very unusual.
Still very strange. But it is amazing how much of a difference that makes, and I am glad that he has finally clarified it. I would still say that the most important Trevor Rogers question is, how is he doing this?
But, yeah,
which I understand Andy has also, you know, written some words about, so it's not Andy's fault. But that's a great clarification, and I hope, has Baseball Reference fixed that?
I don't know. This is like when we were spelling Zach Britton's name wrong for like a decade.
Yeah, no, it's still all right. Sean Forman, get on it, because it's still. Wow, that's wild. All right, thank you for that reporting, Andy. As always, all right, my Ugla is the major league debut of Taylor Rashi. Who? The Diamondbacks have had... Do you have a Rashi joke or a Rambam joke?
I was going to ask when Maimonides is coming up.
All right.
For those of you who don't know...
No. We're moving on. If you get the Rashi reference, mazel tov.
If you're grinding with Shlomo Yitzchak, you know.
Taylor Rashi made his major league debut for the Arizona Diamondbacks. And this is a former 23rd round pick, minor league rule 5 pick. And the debut itself is pretty ugly, because he gets a 3-inning save in a close game against the best team in baseball on the road. Like, why they just left Taylor Rashi out there to do this, I don't know. It speaks to what the status of the Diamondbacks bullpen is this season. And really just like how many people have pitched for the Diamondbacks this year, where I'm just like, where in the world did you come from? And folks, that is not just a feeling. That is an objective reality, as the Arizona Diamondbacks have set a major league record this season for the most different pitchers to record a save. 15 different pitchers have recorded a save for this very average baseball team. And Taylor Rashi has become the latest, breaking a record set tied the 2021 Rays and the 2024 Dodgers. Ever heard of them?
Good team.
Who had 14 last year. But yes, I don't believe anyone else this year has more than 10 different closers. But the Arizona Diamondbacks, with such legends as Juan Murillo,
I was going to say, like, how many of these could I name? Probably six.
I mean, I just gave you the tough ones. You know, we have several multi-inning saves, but we've got
Shelby Miller
and
Justin Martinez.
Who is the leader is Shelby Miller with 10. Justin Martinez, 5. AJ Puck, 4. The Gink with 3. Andrew Solfrank, back from his gambling suspension, has already recorded
99
3.
Cents. Kyle McGowan.
Anthony DeSclafani has 2 somehow. No. McGowan. Do you mean Scott McGuff? He does not have 1. Jake Woodford has 1. Bryce Jarvis. Anyway, you get the point. Taylor Rashi, congratulations. You are continuing to make history. The scholar himself, throwing like 90 miles an hour and just like only splitters, and he closed out the Brewers. It was marvelous to watch. Very ugly.
Shouts out to Rashi.
Shouts out to Rashi. What can we learn from Taylor Rashi? All right.
What does the Drosh say about Taylor Rashi? Okay, that's it. Wrap it up. This podcast is over.
We're done. What do we got coming
up
this week, Jake?
Whoa. What do we got this weekend, dude? It's Friday.
That's
gotta
what I'm
get
saying.
Down on Friday.
Yeah. Yeah,
we've got Mariners are in town for you. That's fun.
Yes. I will be seeing Seattle for all 3 of these games, Labor Day weekend. Looking forward to seeing them, obviously, and the people around them, including Ryan Divish, back from his hiatus. Excited to hang out with him. Brewers Blue Jays is the series of the weekend, folks. The two teams with the best records in both leagues. Squaring off in Toronto, we got Shane Bieber's Rogers Center debut against Freddie Peralta tonight. Diamondbacks against the Dodgers. Zach Allen, who's been pitching great lately. A little late there, buddy, but I guess he's going into free agency, so that's worth something. He's going up against Blake Snell tonight. And Tigers and Royals has my attention as well. If Kansas City's going to make it interesting, it would be nice to see them play well against Detroit this weekend.
It's kind of an underwhelming slate this weekend, and it's a lot of good teams playing bad teams or teams in the mix playing not good teams, right? Like, how many playoff teams are playing one another this weekend?
It's just
Milwaukee and Toronto.
Yep.
And so what that means is, like, those other teams, it's going to be, you need to TCB this weekend, right? The county's best yogurt, for sure.
And we know some of these teams will not be doing that.
Monday morning, we're going to be like,
we will. Oh, another important note.
Tuesday morning.
We will be back on Tuesday. Enjoy your Labor Day. Monday, a lot of day games. So Tuesday will be a bit of a revised weekend recap, Labor Day action reaction. So just 2 shows next week, Tuesday and Friday. But hopefully you enjoy the holiday weekend. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz, as always, for making this show possible. Thank you, Jake Mintz, for recording this pod with me from the Yahoo offices in New York. If you're watching on YouTube, you see I'm not in my office. That's because I'm getting a new roof today. Hopefully you haven't heard too many weird sounds over the course of this recording, but I'm going to stop talking so that it doesn't get any louder. Email us baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. We appreciate the support, and we'll talk to you all next week.